Blog Talk Radio.
All righty, folks. This is Rebel Rouse and Rich Bergeron. We have a pretty good show for you tonight. We got a little bit of a late start here. But we got Mauro Ranallo, the Strike Force commentator on Showtime. Pretty interesting dude from north of the Canadian border there. And we also have our boy Iceman, John Scully, going to talk about.
No shit. Yeah. I actually emailed Iceman today.
Yeah. Well, he's coming on tonight.
Oh, nice. I don't know how many people he copied on this email, but he was asking people if they were going to, be covering the fight next week in Atlantic City between Dawson and Hopkins.
Right.
And unfortunately, I will not be down there.
Oh, no.
And then I commented on his Facebook status about Ice Baby.
Are you going to Armory tomorrow down there? There's fights down there, too. All right.
Oh, yeah. That's a Greg Robinson production. I refuse to go to his cards anymore. They suck all the time.
Oh. All right. I got
family members returning from the Caribbean, so they're coming in. I'm about to hear my dog bark. Can you hear my dog? Yeah, I can't hear a thing right now. I guess.
Internet is so sketchy lately. What's going on? Anyway, we got Mauro Ranallo coming up in about 10 minutes now. Through these results. Also, in addition to Paulo Thiago getting knocked out in the first round, we had Dennis Seaver beat Diego Nunes by unanimous decision. John McGuire beat DeMarcus Johnson by armbar submission in round two. Brad Pickett beat Demetrio Page by rear naked choke submission in the second round. James Head beat Papi Abidi by rear naked choke submission in the first round. Cyril Diabate by majority decision. Francis Carmont beat Magnus Seidenglad by rear naked choke submission in the second round. Riza Madadi beat Yoris Landy Izquierdo by guillotine choke submission in the second round. Simeon Thorson beat Bissam Youssef by submission rear naked choke in the second round. And finally, Jason Young beat Eric Wisely by unanimous decision. That's UFC on Field 2. UFC 145, Jones versus Evans. It's going to be an epic battle. It's kind of reminds me of when Evans fought Liddell. Was pretty big. Or actually, when Rampage fought Liddell, it was a pretty big fight. And kind of a turning point for the league, the UFC league. Evans comes in at 17-1, and he's basically built a guy that's talked a lot of smack about him. John Jones, 15-1. He's a little bit younger, a little bit cockier, a little bit more dynamic. But Evans works hard. You know, you can't underestimate him. And it's going to be a war for sure. They got all kinds of personal issues. They get unique styles. And there's really not many other fights out there for either guy left, you know, to make. So it's definitely going to be a good fight there. Now, for the rest of the fights, we'll see whether we get any real huge fireworks. But we also have Rory McDonald, 12-1, facing Che Mills, who's 14-4. Ben Rothwell, big guy, 31-8 is his record. He's fighting Brendan Schaub from The Ultimate Fighter, who's only 8-2. So it's a big step up for him. Mark Hominick, 20-10, fighting Eddie Yagan, 15-5-1. Mark Bolchek, 10-4, fighting John Alessio, who's 34-14. Miguel Torres, 40-4, fighting Michael McDonald, who's 14-1. Travis Brown, undefeated at 12-0-1, fighting Chad Griggs, who's 11-1. Matt Brown, 13-11, fighting Stephen Thompson, who's 6-0. And John McDessie, 9-1, fighting Anthony Njikuani, who's 14-6. Mac Danzig, 29-1. Fighting Efren Escudero, 18-4-0. Chris Clements, 10-4. Fighting Keith Wisniewski, 28-13-1. Finally, Maximo Blanco, 8-3-1. Fighting Marcus Brimage, who is 4-1. So, it's going to be an interesting one there. Did you get to watch any boxing over this last weekend and Friday Night Fights at all? Man, there was one real war on Friday Night Fights.
I'm trying to remember if there were fights on Friday night. I don't think there were. Now, the fight on Saturday night, I did not see it was on pay-per-view. You know, they had one fight with Abreu and Brandon Rios. And everybody I've talked to said not only did they think Abreu won, they think Abreu like pretty much dominated the fight. The fact that we just won on a split decision, getting two of the three judges' scorecards, they said it was an absolute atrocity. Like I said, I did not see that. And then Juan Manuel Marquez fought on the card. He won. But like I said, it was pay-per-view, so I did not see it.
Abreu actually fought your boy, Hank Lundy, at the Roxy. And it was a decision. The guy's trainer, father, or whatever, I think he's trainer and father, he got right into Hank's face. And he's like,
I remember that. Yeah, I remember that. That was one of the fights you went to, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I was like right there when the guy was just about to get in his face, and Hank's like, I'm from Philadelphia. I'll fight you right now. That was awesome. And, Abreu, I mean, it was a close fight, don't get me wrong, but Abreu had no call.
From what I heard, Abreu was, you know, winning, but they also said he was holding a lot, too. I mean, holding a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, it's tough. It's tough to score some of these, and it's making boxing look bad lately. It seems like one every weekend.
Yeah.
It was up in their face. But that's what happens when you leave it to the judges.
Very true. I mean, Whitaker left it to the judges with Chavez. Hagler left it to the judges with Leonard. You know, when you left it to the judges, you never know what's going to happen.
Right.
I'll tell you, there's some players who did not leave it to the judges. Mark Hanna didn't leave it to the judges versus Walcott.
Nope. He did not.
Oh, get this. So I'm at work the other day, in a bad mood as usual, and we have this one assignment that we have to do every month, and I hate it. We have to take customers that we started like 2 months prior and call them and say, hi, how do you like your service? And usually they say, it'll either be the only answer, What did they say? Yeah, it's great. So I was calling Larry Holmes of Enterprises, expecting to talk to the secretary. Well, Larry answered.
Nice.
Yeah, but me being, I was so shocked. I was like, I asked him a question, and then he said, so I'm like, oh, shit, I'm talking to Larry Holmes. And then I forgot to book him on the show.
No! Sorry. We have some backlog of guests right now for the time being. But
that's good.
Yeah, that's always
things are popping.
But we're going to be on the phone here shortly with Mauro Ranallo, who is quite a colorful commentator over there on Showtime. Strike Force. And it's interesting, you know, he's been there since before the merger there or acquisition of Strike Force by the UFC. So he's seen a lot, and we're going to have to ask him the BAU question, business as usual. Is it really... This is really what they promised going on over there, and what's the deal behind that? I want to know, you know, whether it's King Mo's prophecy is going to come true there, or it's like a dying cancer patient, or if it's really got some legs. And hopefully, Mauro can tell us what he knows. He's an old hockey guy too. He used to do the hockey announcing and stuff. So.
He would have loved the last few games that I watched because they're, you know, more fighting than shooting, you know, checking.
All right. Well, we're gonna get Mauro on the line. He's a Canadian guy, too. So, for all of you folks north of the border listening tonight, you might recognize the accent. Kind of sounds more British, but you be the judge.
Hello.
Hello, Mauro.
Yes, it's Mauro. How are you?
Great. This is Rabble Rousing Rich Bergeron here, and we're on the line with Tony the Tornado Pentacal as well.
Oh, so then I must go by my nom de guerre of the bipolar rock and roller if we're all into monikers already.
All right. How'd you get that nickname?
Well, it's because I am the bipolar rock and roller. I suffer from bipolar affective disorder since I was about 19 years of age, and I've been very vocal about dealing with that part of my life and proving to others who have the similar issues with mental disorder or whatnot, that not only can you live a functional life, but you can live the dream just like me, and it doesn't have to be a death sentence. But I didn't know if you wanted to get that deep right off the bat.
That's all right. We like championing causes of all kinds, and you know, anytime you can use a situation like that to your advantage, you know. More power.
Well, it's not to my advantage. I'm hoping it's to someone, you know, who deserves a crack at life. If I were to show you guys some of the emails or even tweets that I've received from people who, you know, for whatever reason, you know, are in a very dark place, then I think it's only responsible for someone like myself and others in the public eye who, if I can speak from a very personal perspective and hopefully help someone deal with it and get the help they need, then I'm doing my human duty, and it doesn't matter at the end of the day about the fighting if you can help people out.
Exactly. Yeah, I went to military school. We had a big service before self-esteem going through.
Oh, that's awesome. And bless you for – did you go to the military as well then, or did you just go to the school?
I had enough discipline through college. I figured I was going to be a writer and, you know, do that.
Well, another art that is not necessarily dying, but it's always good to hone a craft such as writing, because, you know, when people are starting to talk and write in terms of OMG, WTF, or the letter U, then we've got serious problems.
Yeah, I was lucky. I jumped off the newspaper bandwagon just in time to embrace the internet. So I got off.
Well, there you go. And it's, you know, we're all having to do that nowadays. I just had the weekly television show. In fact, that was the first in Canada, believe it or not, to host a weekly TV show that was dedicated to mixed martial arts. And the network that I work for in Canada, The Score, has gone in a different format, but one that I think is good. It's all live now with you know, different aspects, different sports, and it has allowed me to concentrate on the video and podcast portion of the show, which I do 5 days a week. And you're right. I mean, the internet is, it's funny, the internet didn't create mixed martial arts. I think the internet definitely saved the sport of MMA. And I think, you know, judging by what Dana White and the UFC has done in terms of social networking and social media, you know, it's where we all thrive. And, you know, I think the show that we're on right now is proof of that as well.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. I read a story today that Dana demanded a retraction from Cage Potato.
Well, I had Jason Moles of Cage Potato on the show yesterday, and I don't know if you know, they Sergio Non of USA Today also did an interview with a UFC co-owner Lorenzo Fertitta. And you're right. I mean, Cage Potato, which in case people haven't heard of, and I wasn't too familiar with their concept. I'd heard of it, but you know, I didn't realize that their main claim to fame that they're trying to make people laugh while still trying to cover the news seriously. And yeah, when you put a caption underneath a picture of Dana White that says, you know, he bet $500,000 for John Jones to defeat Rashad Evans on Saturday, and then adds, you know, oh, don't print that, or you know, I shouldn't have said that, or whatever. Yeah, you know, it's in quotation marks. I can understand people, you know, I didn't think it was that funny, mind you, but I can see, okay, it's obviously some kind of a joke. But man, I guess Rashad Evans' camp, according to the interview at the USA Today, you know, Rashad found out about it and he was livid. Like, I guess Dana White had to call him and almost took a half hour to settle him down and convince him that there's no way, you know, he would bet against him. And let's face it, there's no way Dana White, who maybe, you know, there's been photographs, you know, I think he may have a gambling habit like Snoop Dogg, whatever, and then what he does in his own private time is his own business. I you know, there's no way on earth that he is betting on his own company or any of his fighters unless, you know, he wants to break the entire thing down. And I think that's why Lorenzo Fertitta and the UFC have responded the way they have. And I don't blame them in that regard, because it's still a very tenuous position. A lot of people think, you know, the UFC's now signed with Fox. Okay, boom, they've made it. If, you know, if you guys cover the sport, you follow the sport, I can't imagine the stress level that Dana White is under right now with what has just happened in the last, you know, couple of weeks and heading into, you know, a big run for the UFC here, an important one.
Yeah, he doesn't even want to talk about Overeem half the time at the press conferences.
Well, you know, and then that's part of the, I mean, a big part of his stress. And again, as I had talking about today, you know, the fact that it's interesting that a guy who tests for an elevated level of testosterone to epic testosterone at 14 to 1 when the Nevada State Athletic Commission allows a threshold of 6 to 1, which other organizations have a threshold of 4 to 1, which the average male has a 1 to 1 ratio, and who Dr. Johnny Benjamin,
sorry, folks, I don't exactly know where we left off there. Technical difficulties, as always, derailed us there. The internet connection's pretty rough. But we're going to try to get Morrow back on. He did say he'll be in a few minutes, so it's probably unlikely we'll be able to get him for that long, but maybe we'll get him for some part. Maybe I apologize for that.
Tornado.
Sorry about that, Tony. We got a call on the Magic Jack. Screwed us up.
Oh.
Kicked us off again. So. Hopefully we'll get Morrow back. I'm trying him now. But Blog Talk Radio just clipped off. It was like I was talking to you and Morrow. I don't know what happened. I've never had that happen before. At least not recently.
Hello.
Hi, Morrow.
Yeah, what happened there, boys?
Hey, we're back.
Yeah, I don't have too much time left. Oh, you guys, what happened there? That was like 15, 20 minutes ago this happened.
Yeah, it just it disconnected. It's got a problem in the house with the Magic Jack system. It's on another number, so every time that calls it.
Oh, you can't call? Okay, because, yeah, I was maybe, holy shit, what happened? It was like 15, 20 minutes. But I got another 10 or 15 maybe with you guys, so let's just do this.
Sure. Well, I did want to ask you, how did you get started in the MMA business to begin with?
I was a very big fan of mixed martial arts since its infancy, just like everyone else. I think a big percentage of the original MMA fan base, whether they admit it or not now, I was a huge pro wrestling fan. And in fact, I started my broadcasting career in pro wrestling at the age of 16, discovered in high school. And I've talked about that story ad nauseum, but the story is up there for anyone who wants to read it at my website, morrownow.com. But when UFC began, And I, I've been watching what was going on in Japan, and I was one of these guys, even at a very young age, that loved professional wrestling, larger-than-life spectacle, and the fact that it was taking place in a ring, and there was some athleticism to it, and, of course, it's play fighting, it's scripted entertainment, but I thought, imagine this kind of presentation, but if the fights were real, and we started to see it more and more in Japan, not so much with the pageantry at the time, although they liked the spectacle, but not like Vince McMahon. And a lot of people might not know this, but Pride Fighting Championships really spawned from a pro wrestling mentality. One of the biggest Japanese pro wrestling stars of the modern era, Nobuhiko Takada, was supposed to, well, he did fight who was considered one of the great combat sports athletes and mixed martial arts practitioners, a legendary Hickson Gracie from the legendary Gracie family. So a Pride Fighting Championship spawned from a pro wrestling mentality. And when I met Boss Rooney in 2001 in my hometown of Vancouver, British Columbia, he was there doing some television series work as a fight choreographer for a TV series there. And, of course, I knew him as the King of Pancras, the UFC heavyweight champion and a color commentator with Pride Fighting. It just so happened that the same event that we were at, he was at a grappling tournament, as was I, supporting a friend of mine, a former doorman at a nightclub I used to DJ at, because I was also a longtime club and radio DJ. I've done a lot, actually, in these 42 years I've been on this earth. Very blessed to have done all of this stuff. But
you were a hockey guy, too, right?
Absolutely. I've called them. In fact, I'm watching Boston Washington tied at one right now. But, it's funny. People always ask me how I got started, or young broadcasters say, what can I do to begin a career in broadcasting or MMA? The real answer is very simple, but very powerful. You need to fully commit. And I'm starting to realize now, even at 42, the fact that, I don't sleep a lot. I don't need a lot of sleep. And maybe that has to do with being the bipolar rock and roller, as they say. But I eat, live, and breathe my work. But my work is not just mixed martial arts. I have an insatiable curiosity for all things, pop culture, sports, music, movies, film. I really try to cover, know a little bit about everything, so I can converse with the many, wonderful personalities that I get to interview on a regular basis, and just the people that I come across in my many travels. But I was very fortunate to meet Boss Rooney in 2001, and we hit it off on a movie set 2 years later when Pride Fighting Championships was looking for a play-by-play announcer to fill in for the very first Pride Bushido event. Boss, true to his word, said that if I ever have another opportunity to work with you, I'm going to. And he asked for a tape to be sent to Los Angeles. And it's, in October of 2003, he and I teamed up for the first time at the Saitama Super Arena for Pride Bushido 1, which was an amazing night for me for a variety of reasons, not just because it was the dream job, but my two favorite loved professional wrestling and mixed martial arts collided in the main event when Mirko Krokop knocked out who is now known as Alberto Del Rio in WWE, but at the time was known as Dos Caras Jr., Alberto Rodriguez, who, of course, a family rich in lucha libre history, the son of Dos Caras, and, you know, related to the nephew of Neil Máscaras. But to have a guy in a pro wrestling mask, and I was almost in stunned disbelief of the fighter meeting when I found out that, yes, they wanted him to wear a mask. And I'm thinking to myself, when I look at Boss, I'm like, he has to defend against one of the most lethal weapons that I've ever seen, the left head kick of Mirko Krokop, and they're putting a mask on him. And sure enough, and, you know, as we just celebrate the 100th anniversary of the sinking of the Titanic, it was in that fight that I had to call that those cars lasted about as, you know, went down faster than the Titanic. 49 seconds was all it took. So that was my debut. It was the first time there were five members of the Gracie family on one card. Canadian pioneer Carlos Newton, the first Canadian to win a UFC title, was on that card. So that, you know, what a debut. And now I look back and it was only, you know, 9 years ago. A little less than 9 years ago. And it seems like a generation away because of just how much the landscape has changed with the emergence of the Ultimate Fighting Championship. And kudos and congratulations on all the hard work and success that the Zufas organization and, you know, the Fertitta brothers and Dana White have done. But in many ways, you know, the UFC is a completely different sport than Prime in a lot of ways. But it's mixed martial arts. And in a lot, you know, there are some rules that were in Pride with the foot stomps and the soccer kicks that probably would not be, you know, looked upon favorably by the commissions or maybe networks like Fox. So I think the sport maybe has evolved in a way, but I will always, you know, have heart and will always be indebted to Boss Rutan for not only, you know, lending me the job of a lifetime, but being a man of his word and manifesting into one of the best people I've ever met and one of my dearest friends.
Yeah, I met him in person myself back in 2008 in an event in Worcester that he was doing the announcing for a Butterbean show, Mushin MMA. And
yeah,
I was really struck by how friendly he was with the fan base. You know, everybody asked.
Oh, it's not for show. I kid you not. This guy, I remember walking the streets of Japan, where of course he was, you know, known the three-time king of Pancrase. That's where he cut his teeth and really made his mark in MMA and in the you know, one of the earlier organizations. It started actually a month, you know, after the UFC in 1993, and Boss Rutan, Frank Shamrock, Ken Shamrock, Masakatsu Funaki, and Minoru Suzuki, the co-founders, but, you know, so many people, Josh Barnett, Yuki Kondo, I mean, there's so many names you could come up with, but when we were walking the streets of Japan, many people obviously still remembered Boss, and I don't care if there were 20 or if there were 200, every single one of them got personal time with Boss Rutan. And it was so legitimate, so real. And this is why, you know, he is so beloved. This is why he is so successful. And yes, I'll say it right now, he is my like a brother to me. So I'm damn straight going to put him over. But I'm not saying anything that anyone who has never, you know, who has ever come into contact, I should say, would say. He is just an amazing soul. And we are very, very, very blessed to, you know, have had someone like him come into MMA, as we are with so many people. And that's the other thing I hate about the criticism of mixed martial arts or the stigmatization of the sport that, you know, we've worked so hard and granted, it's being, you know, chipped away at by bigger pieces all the time. I think, you know, we're winning them over, but not everyone has won over yet. And so it's interesting when you talk to guys like I've had the chance to do this week, Greg Jackson, a mastermind of strategy, who, of course, is going to be in John Jones' corner when he takes on an original Jackson fighter. Remember the original Jackson 5, Rashad Evans?
Who do you think is going to be the big UFC 145 fight?
I think much closer in terms of what could happen than the 5-1 odds for John Jones indicate. John Bones Jones, what more can be said about him? I'm glad that he is refuting the comparisons to Muhammad Ali. I take umbrage with people saying that Alexander Gustafsson is the next John Bones Jones. First of all, Alexander Gustafsson is 25, Jones is 24. So he was born before him. And secondly, I would not let Alexander Gustafsson be the first Alexander Gustafsson, just like John Bones Jones should be the first John Bones Jones. But what he's accomplished at his age, becoming the youngest UFC champion and talking to Mike Winklejohn and Greg Jackson on the MMA Show podcast this week, the fact that he continues to evolve at an exponential rate and is a sponge. There was the term used by the Team Jackson Winklejohn camp, creative intelligence. And Greg Jackson told me that the only other guy who equals John Jones in creative intelligence, and all fighters have it, he says, but, you know, like all human beings, some people have an average IQ, some people have an above average IQ, some people are Mensa members. When it comes to creative intelligence in MMA, Greg Jackson says John Jones equals George St. Pierre. And, you know, it just boggles the mind to see what his potential is. And this is what is so exciting. We have not seen the best of John Jones, but he will face a very stout test in a guy like Rashad Evans, who has been to the top of the mountain, who has worn the UFC light heavyweight title, who is, you know, going back to being a heavyweight winner on season 2 of The Ultimate Fighter. He has experience. He's 8 years older than Jones, and they, you know, he's faced a consistently high level of competition. And when you look at opponents, Jones is coming off the prayer choke submission over Lyoto Machida at UFC 140 last December in Toronto, retaining the title, while it was the same Machida that knocked out Rashad Evans in his first title defense. So you can take certain things from the past, you can take certain things from what's in between, but when it comes right down to it, when the cage door shuts on Saturday, I think the two question marks are the wrestling. Win or lose, Rashad Evans is always taking down his opponents. We saw it against Phil Davis, a guy who not too long ago was being compared to John Jones. He was dominated in the wrestling, and we're talking, you know, about a champion of Penn State. John Jones has never been taken down. He's got that astronomical 84.5-inch reach. But if Evans is able to somehow find a way to get on the inside without eating a lot of punishment, the leg kicks, and I think Evans should also try to use the leg kicks on the long, skinny legs of John Jones. And people, that's not an insult. It is what it is. The guy has the, you know, long, skinny legs. And if Evans is able to hurt him early in with kicks, then that will maybe offset his amazing balance and the way that he is able to throw kicks or do maneuvers at such an unorthodox fashion. And yet the conventional wisdom has it that Jones, with his reach, his long limbs, his ability to improvise creatively, the creative intelligence we talked about, will maybe be enough to school Evans. I have a feeling either way, this fight might go to 5 rounds.
Yeah, could. But I don't know. I like Jones to just wear him down over time. I actually saw Jones early in his career at Foxwoods. And kind of forgot that I saw him because he knocked the guy out so quick. But then when I went
right
back,
and that's as we've seen, the level of talent gets stiffer, it becomes harder to do this just that. Although again, he's finished his 2 title defenses in very impressive fashion with submissions against Rampage Jackson and the aforementioned Machida. Could he submit Rashad Evans? Sure, but I just think Rashad Evans, it's also got some pretty high fight IQ, and a lot of people say maybe he's allowing the feud with Greg Jackson or the distrust there, whatever. Maybe that's going to impact him. I don't know. I think Rashad Evans is a professional. I don't think he's going to carry that emotion into the fight with him. And like everyone else, I have a feeling that win or lose, whoever wins or loses, both of them will embrace and squash this this long and winding road that features so many personal potholes.
Right. Well, getting back to Strikeforce, seems like we talked more about UFC so far, but, you know, they're the home of women's MMA now on the biggest scale that we've seen it. And also the Strikeforce is coming up with the heavyweight finals there for the Grand Prix. Tell us a little bit about your perspective on both of those, the women and the heavyweights. Actually,
yeah, Strikeforce returns with the, speak of long and winding road, we've waited over a year to see Jones versus Evans. Same can be said to the resolution of the Strikeforce Heavyweight Grand Prix, but it is coming to an end on May 19, and a very compelling final matchup. Is, you know, one of the top heavyweights in the world, and a guy who he has popped three times for performance-enhancing drugs. And again, it's just so bad that we have this hot-button topic that continues to rear its ugly head. But when you take all that away, Josh Barnett is a tremendous talent representing catch wrestling, a guy who's actually been able to have a successful professional wrestling career synonymously with a successful MMA career. And one of the reasons I think, despite, you know, the personal beefs he's had in the past with Dana White, that he, you know, probably hasn't been too eager to get back to the UFC is the fact that, yeah, he can still also do one of his loves, pro wrestling. But in this fight, he faces a real wrestler in Daniel Cormier, one of the great NCAA wrestlers, the two-time Olympian, including being Olympic captain in the year that he could not wrestle, and the guy that has made a seamless transition, a mixed martial arts at American Kickboxing Academy under the tutelage of the likes of Javier Mendez and, of course, Crazy Bob Cook. But Daniel Cormier, with the biggest win of his career, you know, as an injury replacement in the semifinals, knocking out Antonio Bigfoot Silva, breaking his hand, right hand with that first punch that he landed that knocked down the big man. It's been a long road back. It's been a tough road back, the injury. And I'm wondering really what he will be like against a guy like Josh Barnett, who has a ton more experience, a lot more tricks up the proverbial sleeve, and yet, for Josh Barnett, I wonder, you know, the youth, it's not even youth. I mean, Cormier has, you know, obviously got a late start in the MMA game after the wrestling career. But I'm just wondering who's going to be the better striker. I think whoever is able to test the other in the striking department will prevail. And, you know, because I'm calling the fight with Frank Shamrock and Pat Miletich, and I think all broadcasters that I've talked to kind of take this stance. I don't want to make a prediction on fights that I call because I don't want it to seem that I'm favoring anyone. But in terms of the women,
you're not going to fight either, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, exactly. 135-pound women's division is really intriguing right now. And what we just saw with Ronda Rousey, and what a story she is, storming into the world of MMA after being an Olympic judoka and winning a, you know, bronze medal for the States, the first American woman to medal, and just an amazing life story. And, of course, you know, the armbar queen that she is, winning the title from Misha Tate, who's been another tremendous ambassador of the sport. And what was a real entertaining fight for the amount of time it lasted. But you take a look at those ladies. You have Sarah Kaufman, the former champion, who many people thought should have actually challenged Misha Tate that night instead of Ronda Rousey, who was making her 135-pound debut after, campaigning at 145. But Sarah Kaufman and Alexis Davis in a rematch of Alexis Davis's, I think it was her, might have been her professional debut, if I'm not mistaken. But anyway, early in her career, Kaufman stopped Alexis Davis. Well, these two ladies, they stole the show the last time around, and one of the more memorable brawls of the year. They just let it go. And Alexis Davis telling me, you know, that she'd been working on the fact she wasn't going to get caught up and just moving straight ahead without head movement. And yet, that's exactly what happened. And yet, she showed her resilience. She showed her heart. And it was a fight that both of their stocks were raised in terms of fan friendliness. And so I really think the women's 135-pound weight division is one to look at Strikeforce. And, of course, Invicta, I'm very happy to be a part of the inaugural broadcast of the first all-women's promotion coming up on Saturday, April 28th in Kansas City with a rematch in the main event there with former Strikeforce champion Marlous Kunin. I still can't, you know, I can't wrap my head around the fact that she's still not with Strikeforce. That's some weird, she's caught in the middle of all that Overeem Golden Glory mess, and yet Marlous Kunin should be in Strikeforce. But hey, if that's not the case, then Invicta's a great place to be because, man, you talk about a commitment to the sport of female MMA, Shannon Knapp and company doing a great job there. And like I say, Marlos Kunin versus Romy Nguyen in the main event in a rematch. Kunin won the original meeting, and so women's MMA is here to stay. And I think eventually, I mean, even with this past fight with Tate and Rousey, first time that Dana White, who has been a huge vocal critic of the fact that he doesn't feel there's enough quality talent to have a women's division, he won over by Rousey and Tate. And I think, you know, Chris Cyborg's suspension for a year has been upheld for steroids, but when she comes back, there is that potential grudge match with Rousey, maybe going up to 145 in a dream fight. And like I say, Invicta is now having women's cards. And there's a lot of untapped potential talent out there. And I think female MMA is not going to be like female boxing. I think there is going to be a continued growth. And I just hope the fans come out, especially on April 28th in Kansas City, to support the ladies. Because when the ladies were on, you know, on the other kinds of shows dominated by men, they usually steal it.
Yeah, it's kind of like they're fighting for all of womankind, not just for the women.
There you go. Yeah. I'm not going to get into the Mitt Romney, whatever, Democrat politics. What was the old saying about moms? And Romney never worked a day in her life. Yeah. I tend to stay away from women's issues. I usually get in trouble.
Yeah. Well, what do you? What would you say you love most about your job and just the sport of MMA in general?
The fact that I get to talk about it every day, the fact that I get to experience it firsthand at cage side or ringside, and the fact that, you know, I'm living the dream. It's, you know, it's cliche, melodramatic, might even be cheesy, but from 5 years old, I visualized my life, and everything I've accomplished was part of it. And I just say to everyone listening, and I know times are tough, and sure, luck plays a part of it as well, but man, if you just, it's my trademark, and I don't even know where I read it, it might have been in a Carnegie book or whatever, it's conceive, believe, achieve, and the many wonderful people, not just the fighters, but the trainers, and the staff, the promotions, and even the arena, it's just so many great people I come across, and the fact that I get to do it while, you know, earning a good living. A small guy, a kid from Mount Lehman, British Columbia, you know, the part of the first broadcast team on CBS with, you know, great broadcaster Gus Johnson and Frank Shamrock and Karen Bryant, who just recently made her debut on the Fuel broadcast for UFC. I mean, I've just had a very blessed career, and the fact that I'm only 42, I have a feeling the best is yet to come.
Yeah, I can remember. I really was a newcomer to MMA watching. I started in about 2006, and I kind of heard the legend, but I never really saw it in person until 2006 when it came on Showtime. So,
right.
So you guys helped me introduce me to MMA, and I.
Well, that's great, and that's and one of the things I like to talk about is the fact that there was the sport before the Ultimate Fighter Season 1 in April of 2005. But it's funny, there was a sport before then, and the history needs to be respected because Pride was legendary. Without the Ultimate Fighter Season 1 in April of 2005, I don't know if there'd still be a sport today. That's this crazy thing about MMA.
Yeah, it's come a long way, baby.
Yes, it has. Nobody puts baby in the corner, by the way.
All right. Well, Mauro, it's been great talking to you. I don't want to hold you too long here. And
no worries. I appreciate it, guys, and thanks for your time and support. And I just hope your listeners will have a chance to check out the MMA Show podcast. We eat, live, and breathe it 5 days a week, 2 o'clock Eastern. The video stream is on thescore.com. And if it's making news in MMA, you damn sure we're covering it.
All right. Well, you do a great job, and I like listening to you, and I definitely appreciate you as a guest. I think you've shed a lot of light on a lot of stuff. Sorry about the technical difficulties there, but...
Oh, no worries, man. Hey, I've had some plastic technical difficulties this week on my show, and it's how you handle it, and you guys handled it fine, and it was fun talking to you, and anytime, you know, I get to talk about my Pride days, or even the current climate, you know, this is something, like I say, I'm doing it at the dinner table, I'm doing it in the studio, and then that's one of the reasons why maybe I'll be a bachelor for life.
That's all right, you know.
Before you got off the air, was we had a combination of hockey and MMA and pro wrestling. I'm a Philadelphia guy. We got the Flyers and the Penguins. It's going to game five. My Flyers are up 3-1. Can they finally put these guys away?
I think the question that needs to be asked is, if you're a Pennsylvania guy, have you seen the goalies on the side of the milk cartons yet? 45 goals combined?
This is horrible.
45? The two teams have combined for an NHL record 45 goals in the first four games of a series, and 10-3. The Penguins hanging a 10 spot on them to stay alive last night was unbelievable. But having said all of that, I hate to say this, man, because you're a Philly boy, and that's fine. My team is the beloved Broadway Blue Shirts, the New York Rangers, who also choked last night, giving up a two-goal lead and losing in overtime. But I think the Flyers are going to maybe see a reverse sweep here, buddy.
Wow.
I think the Penguins are going to come back, and I know it's only happened, three or four times in league history. They might sweep a reverse sweep here.
The last team to do it was the Flyers 2 years ago.
Well, that's right. I remember that. The Flyers, and then there was the Maple Leafs in the 70s and the Islanders. No, sorry. The Islanders in the 70s and the Maple Leafs way back when.
If you're on Facebook or not, but if you are, have Rich put you onto my page. I have pictures from this year's Winter Classic alumni game with all the greats like Bobby Clark.
Oh, man, that must have been awesome, buddy.
Unbelievable.
What an experience. I would love to check out one of those. Actually, Heidi Andrel, who's one of my colleagues at Showtime for Strikeforce, she worked the classic for the NHL Network, and she told me it was just a blast.
Yeah, it was unbelievable. I got it.
All right, guys. Well, it's been really good talking to you, and I hope you guys will keep up the good work. And, yeah, we're back on Showtime May 19 from the HP Pavilion in San Jose in a stacked card, and maybe as we get closer to that, we'll talk to you again.
All right, cool. Yeah. We're looking forward to seeing you do your business as usual.
All right. Yeah. Good one. All right, guys. Thanks.
Have a good one. Thanks. Bye. So there's Morrow, and we also have a scheduled slot here with the Iceman. So Tony can come out of his catatonic state.
I'm actually conversing with the Iceman as we speak.
Oh, he's waiting for us?
No, I have no idea. We're talking about important things on Facebook, like Apollo Creed.
Okay. Does he know he's on?
I have no idea. Hello?
Hey, John. How's it going?
Yeah, pretty good. How you doing?
Good. We're live on the Fight News Unlimited Combat Sports Show here. We got Tony the Tornado, and this is Rabble Rousing Rich, and we have the Iceman on the other line. How's it going?
Everything's great. Good to be here.
Yeah.
Nothing's better than talking about the great Apollo Creed on Facebook at the same time.
Exactly. Ain't gonna be no rematch.
Right. How you doing, John?
Everything's great. Just over here at the casino, working on my book a little bit and checking things out.
So how's the big training camp been like for the Hopkins fight with Chad Dawson there?
It's been spectacular. We were just talking today, and he said just he feels so great, and just, you know, he's really, really anxious to get to Atlantic City and get in the ring for the fight. And so I'm actually more excited just after seeing him be so excited, you know?
Right. And what's the difference in, you know, what you've done, if anything, to get ready for this fight as opposed to the last one? Did you do anything different?
You know what? The theme of the training camp is just kind of we picked up where we left off. I mean, we really trained well for the last fight. He mentioned to me before the last fight that this was the best he ever felt going into a fight. And this particular fight, he came back to the gym sooner than he ever did ever in his entire career to start training again for the next fight. So he's really maturing and covering all the bases. And so basically we're just picking up where we left off, getting stronger and stronger. We're going to be stronger than we were, more focused, everything. It's just, we worked out a few different techniques and strategies, but the general idea is the same. We're going to, the fight really didn't get too deep where we saw anything we needed to change.
Right. Now,
I didn't get to see you until a couple days later. So I had already gone in, obviously knowing what the outcome was. And I forget where I was the night that the fight took place. I know I had an event that I was attending. I don't remember what. But I heard two differentiating opinions, both from respected boxing scribes. I know, because I read a lot of boxing stuff. I mean, I go on, chat rooms. I read blog articles. I read anything I can. And sometimes you get, a 13-year-old kid, and he's sitting out there, and he's just babbling, what he thinks. But the two reports that I remember reading were both respected boxing writers, and the opinions were so widely different. How the fight was progressing in the round and a half that it, transpired before the for the premature ending. I remember the one writer, and I apologize for not remembering their name, was really praising Chad. Said, he was boxing very sharply, and they said he looked about two levels faster than Bernard did. And I remember them saying the word dominating. That's the word I remember reading. The other scribe was saying that, Hopkins was, in one of his traditional trying to set things up and set traps and gave Bernard the first round and said, he was thwarting Dawson's attack. And this was obviously, before the clinch and then the injury to Hopkins. So I remember going in, talking to people before the fight took place, saying it was going to be a fight on game plans, that if Chad was able to, use a jab, control the tempo, and use a lot of high offense, similar to what Joe Calzaghe did, that he would have a very good chance of, unseating Hopkins. I said, on the other hand, if Hopkins, made it into a chess match to an unexciting fight, then he had a chance of thwarting Dawson's offense and, winning one of his traditional, maybe ugly decisions. Being in the corner, how do you think that fight was progressing up until the end?
Well, to be honest with you, as I recall sitting there watching it, one thing I always say, the fight doesn't really, really start until the fourth or fifth round anyway, so it's hard for me to go by the early rounds. But I definitely felt that Chad was making the fight and was strong. I felt that it was obvious he was a much stronger physically guy. And I distinctly remember getting the feeling that Bernard didn't want to engage and that he was like he was falling for a lot of feints. And one time, actually, it was almost like Chad fainted kind of hard and Bernard just went right back to the ropes and covered up quickly, which was good for me. I was glad to see that because painting was going to be a part of the repertoire that night. But I didn't really think Hopkins was doing anything. It seemed like he was trying to take his time to get into the fight. I didn't really feel any huge threat at that point. At the point the fight ended, I was pretty comfortable. I remember that.
Now, how upset were you both, you and Chad, when that fight ended the way it did? Were you even upset, or were you thrilled?
I was very. It was like the air came out of me. Obviously you saw how upset Chad was on TV, but with me being next to the ring, I remember putting my head down. Actually, while it was all going on, before they even called the fight, I put my head down on the ring step, like the perch step up, just the air went out of me because I knew it was over. As soon as Hopkins went down, I knew it was over. I knew he wasn't going to get up. Whether he was hurt or not, you know, I don't know. But I just had the feeling that even whether he was hurt or not, he wasn't going to get up. I saw the look on his face, and he just made up his mind, like, that's it. It's over. We're gonna have it out some other way. And so I was, I don't know what the word is, devastated, I guess. I was devastated because we really trained hard. It was really building up into something big, and then all of a sudden, boom, the air goes out of the balloon.
Yeah.
After the fight was over, and this was before they even had the hearings, and at the time it was still considered a TKO win for Dawson, before they reversed it to a no contest, I actually was able to do a pro and con argument for both sides. And I said, you know what? I watched through an article since I was about maybe 12 years old.
Oh, did we lose Tony? We lost Tony. Tony talked himself off the page.
Well, you're still here.
Yeah.
Hey, we still on?
Yeah.
Okay.
Dropped this time.
No, what I was saying was I made an argument on both sides. I was watching Bernard, come a Philadelphia guy, of course. Well, he was fighting small three-rounders at the Blue Horizon that were swing fights on Tuesday night fights. And so I followed his career since the beginning. When he lost his title fight with Roy Jones, then, when he won from there. And I said, I remember a fight, it was maybe about his fourth or fifth title defense against a guy by the name of Robert Allen, where something similar happened. It was a rough and tumble fight against the Southpaw. And it was getting kind of ugly in there. And then Mills Lane pushed Bernard out of the ring, and he sprained his ankle, and, the fight got halted, ruled in the contest, and, they fought a rematch 6 months later. But then on the other hand, I remember a fight with Antoine Eccles, when Eccles body slammed him and dislocated his shoulder, and then Hopkins fought on. So I said, I've seen them where it's, and then I saw the fight with Roy Jones, the rematch, and then the fight with Calzaghe, where they were questionable fouls, and Bernard embellished them. So I said, you can make an argument that the guy was, not as hurt as he portrayed himself, because you've seen it in the Allen fight, you've seen it in the second Jones fight, you've seen it in the Calzaghe fight. Then, on the other hand, you can make a compelling argument that maybe the guy would have continued if he was allowed. I'm not saying that he would or he wouldn't, because of his fighting on with a separated shoulder in the second Antoine Eccles fight.
Well, my feeling is this, and we were actually just talking about this last night, and as a fighter, a former fighter myself, I'll tell you this much. A fighter will do everything he can to hide any injury. That's just the way it is. Like if Marvin Hagler was ever injured in any manner in his career, we don't know about it because he didn't let it be known. Like every fighter knows you have to hide it. And, like you said, he said he would have fought with one arm. He said that, like, he knows once you tell the referee one arm is out of whack, it's over, the referee's going to let you fight with one arm. So some people are like, oh, he was trying to fight with one arm. But I look at it like he knew there was that they weren't going to let him fight. Like, he did not want to continue. Now, whether he was hurt or not, I don't know. But I'm saying his body language, because no one's ever really brought this up, but he never stood up. He's on the ground. He stayed there. As soon as he went to the ground, and that's why I was so upset, because as soon as he went down, I knew he wasn't going to even attempt to get up. I knew from his body language that the fight was over. Now, I expect a guy that wants to fight to at least stand up. Like Bernard's trainer, after the fight, he was talking about street fighting and how, Bernard has had street fights, and that, he was bred for that mentality. Chad wasn't a street fighter, that type of thing. But, and to that I say, if you're in a street fight and you lay down and you get hurt and you sit on the ground, you know what happens?
You get pummeled.
More guys come over and kick you in the head five or six times. That's what happens. So his best fighting skills certainly weren't there,
Yeah, that's interesting.
So, my point is, if you want to fight, you get up. Vinny Pazienza in that same situation would have got up. Joe Rogatti would have got up. Joe Frazee would have got up. You know, and so that's my thing. Like, you can't say you want to fight while you're sitting down. That just goes against logic. It doesn't make sense. So, you know, I think Hopkins at this point in his career, he's kind of in a situation where he embellishes things and he gets away with as much as he possibly can get away with. And I have the feeling that maybe it's just a theory that maybe he was hoping that Chad was disqualified. I think maybe when that happened, he instinctively thought Chad was at fault and that Chad would get disqualified. And then it kind of blew up in his face. You know, the only thing I'm sure of, above all else, is that he didn't get up. He didn't try to get up. So it was very clear from his words and especially from his actions that he didn't want to even try to get through whatever injury he had.
That's interesting you bring up Marvin Hagler, because we had Richard Steele on a few weeks ago, and he was telling us about how Hagler kept telling him, there ain't no way you're going to stop this on cuts.
Oh, yeah, the fight with Hearns.
Tommy Hearns.
Oh, let me tell you, I always talk about that. Let me tell you the funniest quote. I don't know if he said it to you, but they said the referee, because I know a guy kind of, I know the whole corner, like Goody and Pat and all the guys that were on Hagler's team. I used to train at their gym. I was actually training there while that fight was going on. And I remember he said, the referee asked him when they checked his eye for the blood, right before the knockout, and they asked him, he said, can you see? And Marvin said, I ain't missing him, am I? And the referee, the doctor said, okay, go ahead. And that's what swayed the doctor to let him fight, because he said that. And I just thought that was great.
That's a good one. That's a good one.
Yeah.
We were talking about Vinny Paz earlier. I remember in his last fight, when he got the real bad cut under his cheek, and they took him to the doctor, and I remember him saying, I got worse cuts shaving.
Right. Yeah, well, that's, you know, I used to spar with Vinny. I know Vinny very well, and I'll say this much. And when he got knocked out by Roy Charles, which was, like, that knockout was so vicious. Like, that combination was so vicious, that last one. And he was on the ground, like, fighting with the referee, trying to let the referee let him get up. You know, who would do that? I mean, Vinny, you know, you could break his arm. He'd get up, he'd try to get up, and he would tell you, I'm okay, I can fight, you know, when everybody knows he's not okay. So that's my thing with Hopkins. My only, like, really knock on Hopkins is that, you know, just the fact that he said that to the referee, like, I'll box with one arm. Well, that's a coded way of saying, hey, let me get out of here. Like, I can't fight, and I know you're not going to let me fight with one arm. So, you know, that's my only, you know, question mark there.
Now, John, again, going back to, you mentioned Goody there, of course. Talk a little bit about the time that you put Goody and Angelo together, seeing as how they died so close together.
Oh, yeah, it was kind of spooky if you look back on it. But in 2010, I was at the Foxwoods Casino for a fight, and Goody actually had one of his boxers on the show that night. And, you know, I know Goody very well, so I was down there in the dressing room talking. And then a little bit later, I was upstairs, and somebody said Angelo Dundee was there. And right away, I'm like, oh, man, you know, that's Hagler and Leonard right there. They're both trainers are here. This is remarkable. And I don't know, I can't remember if I asked Angelo to come downstairs or I waited until he went down there, but whatever the case was, I remember I went out into the hallway and I said, hey, Mr. Dundee, I said, I got a guy in here in this room. I think you're really going to want to see this guy. And he came with me and I brought him in, and there was Goody. And I just stood there while they talked, and it was, you know, it was really interesting. They're talking about fights and about this guy and that guy. And at one point I asked him, I said, hey, you know, would you guys mind if I take a picture of you together? And they took a picture together, and I actually put it online. They're on several websites, put it up, and it was a great shot. And it's just amazing to me. Like, if someone would have said to me that night, hey, you know, in about a year and a half, both of these guys are going to pass away within a week of each other, you know, who would believe that? And so it's kind of a piece of history there, you know?
Yeah, it was amazing that happened. And, you know, it was kind of interesting to watch that Friday night fights that week. You know, it was kind of unfortunate they gave almost the entire segment to Angelo, and they only spent about 5 minutes on Goody, but, you know, they did take a good amount of time to recognize both guys and, you know, their stories and stuff. And
right.
Of course, you know, you can't beat the guy who worked with Ali, you know, so I guess Angelo got the nod for that more than anything.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah. But tell us a little bit about your stable. Who else is showing some promise, and who else are you working with these days down there?
I mean, to say the truth, I don't have a large stable right now. Working with some local guys, four-round fighters, that type of thing. And I actually have a pretty good amateur team that I work with. We actually have a big meet coming up, and of all places, we're going to Philadelphia in June. Bringing a whole team of 12 boxers to Philadelphia to box into a meet against a team from Philly. So, so that's kind of my main focus. You know, training Chad takes a lot of time and effort, and it's hard to focus on other guys' pros. You know, like we've been away now for training camp for 7 weeks. I've been away from my gym and the fighters there. But, you know, basically I concentrate on Chad and the amateurs right now.
Right. And how long have you known Chad personally?
Oh, I first knew him when he was 11. He was actually, you know, I've always had my strong amateur teams, and his amateur coach had their team, and we're only about 25 minutes from each other, so we used to travel all the time to tournaments, and I actually worked Chad's corner a few times when he was about 14 in different tournaments when his amateur coach couldn't make it. And then we started sparring with each other when he was about 15. You know, and for a couple of years, he was much smaller than me. I mean, I just worked with him. But then when he got up to be around 165 as an open class, you know, as a grown man, he we had some really, really, really good sessions, 12 rounds at a time. So, you know, I've been with him on all levels since he was a young kid.
Awesome.
John, if I can remember correctly, I think you sent out a picture. I know I'm on your email distribution list. Was Chad the fighter when he was a young guy that was in that infamous Super Soaker drive-by photo?
I couldn't hear you there. Say that.
Was Chad that was the fighter when he was a young guy that was in that, the picture, I think he called it the Super Soaker drive-by?
Was he in that one? Let me think. The Super Soaker drive-by. There's a lot of Super Soaker pictures. You mean the one when he was outside the door and then the water was in the air on its way to hitting him in the head? Yeah, that was me. That was me shooting the gun, and somebody else took the picture. And yeah, it was amazing. He was looking away from the camera, and you could see the stream of water is about 5 feet long, and it's just about to hit him. Yeah, it's actually one of my Facebook albums. It's on there.
I remember when you sent that. Because I sent that to a bunch of people. I was like, because Chad was, you know, world champ at the time in the Senate. I was like, yeah, and I've said to all my friends that are big time fight guys, I'm like, if you got a few out of this, is hysterical. And I remember even talking to him a year ago, I'm like, I got a friend that's got the best picture of a young Chad Dawson. And I said, he's just about to get blasted with a Super Soaker shot.
I have some really good ones with him. That's probably the most interesting one. But I have another one of him and I actually right in the middle of a pillow fight. I don't know if you ever saw that one. It's on my Facebook album. But I'm actually winding up with the pillow. I'm about to hit him with it, and he's like flinging his back at me. And that was actually from a year before that other Super Soaker picture was taken.
Awesome. Now, where did you get that jab? That's one of my favorite punches of his, is jab. When did he develop that style, jab?
You know what? When I first started training him officially in 2004, I had just got done where him and I had sparred many times. And it's funny because we used to spar, and I used to say to myself, this guy has a really good jab, but he doesn't use it that much. And what I would do was, you know, I had a lot of experience with the Pulse, so I would talk trash to Chad to get him mad so that he would abandon his jab and then, you know, kind of settle down and try to bang with me more. And that gave me a much better chance to do well with him because he gave up his height because he wanted to sit down and really hit me hard. So when I started training him, I said, listen, I'm going to tell you something about, you know, our sparring sessions. And I said, you know, with your height and your talent, your speed and the reflexes and the whole package, you're supposed to stay behind your jab. You're supposed to have a wicked, nasty jab. And I used to tell him about Tommy Hearns and Larry Holmes especially. And I said, you know, you don't need to be inside and trying to bang. I said, you could dictate every fight you're ever going to be in for the rest of your life with just the jab. You have that kind of capability. And so I brought him to a gym one time to spar. And there was a boxer there, a rough kid, a middleweight. And I said, okay. I said, look, here's what we're going to do. We're going to spar this kid. And I only want you to use the jab. I want you to stay behind the jab and use your jab as a weapon. Don't throw any left hands, just the jab. So he does that for the first round, which is really good. And so I tell him, I said, okay, keep it up. I want to punish this kid just with the jab. Let's see what you can do with just your jab. And after the second round, the other guy's trainer stopped it. He said, all right, that's good, that's good. And I'll never forget it. The kid came to the gym the next day, the other kid, it was a white kid, and both his eyes underneath were black, as black as tar. And I've seen, you know, blue eyes and purple eyes, but I've never actually seen black eyes before. And both eyes are black. And I brought Chad over and said, look at that. Look at it. I said, you did that just with your jab. And from that day on, he was hooked. That was back in 2004. And once he saw that, he was just like a kid in a candy store. He couldn't believe it. And, you know, that was one of the reasons why we got back together for the last fight, because he mentioned specifically he wanted to get back to having that type of jab.
Yeah, I remember watching him when he was at his peak with that thing, and just at the beginning of his career where he's stringing all those wins together and seemed like he was unstoppable. You know, that was the one thing that I always noticed about him. Even when I really didn't watch a lot of boxing, I liked watching him because that was always my jab. My favorite punch when I boxed was the jab. And even after I stopped boxing, I would always, you know, tell people at parties and stuff, oh, yeah, I used to box. And I'd say, you know, you want to box? I'll just fight you one-handed. And I just put one glove on, and I'd use the jab. And, you know, quick jab, power jab, you know, you mix it up enough. And the key, you never let the person think that you can't throw it right in their face in 2 seconds, you know. And that's the mix between the power and the speed is what I to perfect. And, you know, of course, you're always going to have your knockout punches if you're a heavier weight, but, you know, the jab is just so incredibly useful if you know how to use it. Just keep it in somebody's face defensively. They can't get inside. I mean, Manny Pacquiao does it sometimes, but he does more of the one-twos, and it just kind of makes it hard for people to wade in against him because he's always throwing something. But nobody jabs like Chad.
No, that's for sure. And I always told him that. I said, you know, you should have the best jab in the world. I said, you have all the physical attributes to make it happen. And, you know, he just needed to learn how to throw it. Like, he threw it just because he was told to throw it. You know, he didn't really know why he was throwing it or anything. And you know, so I explained that all to him. And we really worked on that quite a bit. And he gets a lot of leverage into it. And, you know, I was telling Larry Holmes had the best jab in history. And, you know, having watched videos of Larry sometimes, see the form that it brings.
All right, so I'm going to tell you something pretty funny now that you just mentioned that. I was telling Rich when we got on the air. I'm working, you know, I was laid off from my job a couple of years ago when I took a job working at a pest control company right outside of Philadelphia. We cover the north and northeast part of the city, and then we also cover all the northern suburbs as high as Allentown and eastern PA. Well, we got Larry Holmes' business as one of our accounts about 2 months ago. And I didn't have much to do with the setup of it. You know, the sales rep went there, and she's like, oh, I meet Larry all the time. We sit down for coffee and everything. Now, I met Larry about 10 years ago, and I'll tell you that in a second. But You know, we set up the business, and the first two times my guy went there, Larry wasn't even there. So now I have to do my 2 month later customer call, you know, just a courtesy, hi, do you like our service, which I hate doing. I call up expecting the secretary, and Larry picks up. And I'm not even thinking that I'm talking to the former heavyweight champion of the world. I'm sitting there saying, yes, sir, and are you happy with our service? He's like, no, a bug just bit my leg. Hey, I'm kidding with you, man. I'm like, yeah, Larry Helms. He goes, yeah. I'm like, sir, I met you about 10 years ago to fight Carden Allentown, and we started talking a little bit about boxing, and I became a former, you know, college, you know, All-American, and we talked a little bit, and I told him, I'm like, I forgot to get him to do the show with me. I didn't tell Larry at the time we met. We took a photo together, and he seemed very, like, annoyed taking the photo. And when I developed it, I realized he was wearing a Rocky Marciano T-shirt.
Yeah, you were?
Yeah.
Great. Perfect.
All right, well, we got 60 seconds or some change here left to go. So do you got any final thoughts or anybody you want to... John, final thoughts?
Yep. Just, you know, I hope everybody tunes in. It's Chad, I talked to him today after the gym. He's very excited about the fight. He's ready to go. You know, I think he's going to show the people what they've been waiting for from him for the last few years.
Awesome. Well, I can't wait to see it, and I'm sure he's going to do a great job, and you're going to give him the best advice possible. So
I definitely will.
Looking forward to that 47-year-old getting his ass kicked.
Me too. I appreciate you guys having me on the show.
You're welcome. Anytime.
It was a pleasure.
We always wish we had more time with you.
Okay, and anytime. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. All right, adios, folks. Special thanks to MillerFidel.com. They sponsored this week's episode and going to be working with us on a bunch of things. Adios. Until next week.
See you later.